This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
I want to start today by... I had a conversation a little bit ago about this place with... one of the caretakers, centuries beings here, Yelena, who's here, about how this place is a refuge. But it's actually, maybe that isn't the correct term for it to be, because maybe that's one of the things it is. But in this world where there's so much going on, where the ugliness of what man can do to man is happening, where people are unable to do what they dearly want to do because of the constrictions around, Jikoji is also a place of opportunity where for people of spirit to come and be themselves, you know, and maybe that's what it is more, instead of a refuge, it's a place of to practice how to get along and how to make the world a better place. And so I guess I bring that up because... you know, everybody wonders what's going to happen next or what's going to happen in 5 or 20 years, 100 years. And taking best care is one of the things I think that's part of this practice in our vows that we make. But today I'm also want to touch on joy, which you brought up yesterday. Thank you, Carolyn, for that excellent talk. And many different ways to approach it. So I'm going to start by reading a story. This is translated by Professor William Powell. He's in Santa Barbara, emeritus professor of Buddhist studies. And I would say 55 years ago for his PhD thesis, I think one of the main elements of it was his translation of Dongshan, who was a crucial teacher in Soto Zen and in Zen. And so this is his translation of one of the stories. Dongshan went to visit Kuishan and said to him, "I have recently heard that the national teacher, Chung of Nanyang, maintained the doctrine that non-sentient beings expound the Dharma, have not yet comprehended the subtleties of this teaching. And Kuishan said, "Can you, Dongshan, remember the details of what you heard?" And Dongshan said, "Yes, I can." He said, a monk asked Hui Chung, "What sort of thing is the mind of the ancient Buddhas?" The national teacher replied, "The wall and tile rubble." "Wall and tile rubble? Isn't that something non-sentient?" asked the monk. "It is," replied the national teacher. And the monk said, "And yet it can expound the Dharma?" "It is constantly expounding it, radiantly expounding it without ceasing," replied the national teacher. The monk asked, Then why haven't I heard it? And the national teacher said, you yourself haven't heard it, but this can't hinder those who are able to hear it. The monk asked, then why haven't I heard it? The national teacher said, you yourself haven't heard it, but this can't hinder. No, I've already read that. Those who have already been able to hear it. What sort of person acquires such hearing? And the national teacher replied, all the sages have acquired such hearing. The monk asked, can you hear it, Hoshang? No, I can't, replied the national teacher. The monk said, if you haven't heard it, how do you know the non-sentient beings expound the Dharma? The national teacher said, fortunately, I haven't heard it. If I had, I would be the same as the sages, and you, therefore, would not have heard the Dharma that I teach. In that case, ordinary people would have no part in it, said the monk. I teach for ordinary people, not sages, replied the national teacher. Well, what happens after ordinary people hear you? Asked the monk. Then they are no longer ordinary people. The monk asked, according to which sutra does it say that non-sentient beings expound the Dharma? The national teacher replied, clearly you shouldn't suggest that it's not part. No, the monk goes on to say, clearly you shouldn't suggest that it's not part of the sutras. Haven't you seen it in the Avatamsaka Sutra? It says the earth expounds Dharma, living beings expound Dharma throughout the three times. Everything expounds it. The master thus completed his narration, and Kuei Shan said, that teaching also exists here. However, one seldom encounters someone capable of understanding it. Tungshan said, I still don't understand it clearly. Would the master please comment? Kuei Shan raised his fly whisk. He said, saying, do you understand? No, I don't. Please, Hoshan, explain. And Kuei Shan said, it can never be explained to you by means of the mouth of one born of mother and father. Tungshan asked, does the master have any contemporaries in the way who might clarify this problem for me? From here, go to Yuhuoxuan of Liling, where you will find some linked caves. Living in those caves is a man of the way, Yunyan. If you are able to push aside the grass and gaze into the wind, then you will find him worthy of your respect, said Kunxian. Just what sort of man is he? Yunyan is famous Zen teacher. Anyway, Kunshan replied, once he said to this old monk, what should I do if I wish to follow the master? This old monk replied, you must immediately cut off your defilements. He said then, will I come up to the master's expectation? And this old monk replied, you will get absolutely no answer as long as I am here. Tungshan accordingly took leave of Kuei Shan and proceeded directly to Yunyan's, making reference to his previous encounters. He immediately asked what sort of person was able to hear the Dharma expounded by non-sentient beings. And Yunyan said, non-sentient beings are able to hear it. Can you hear it, Hoshang? Asked Tungshan. Yunyan replied, "If I could hear it, then you would not be able to hear the Dharma that I teach." "Why can't I hear it?" asked Tongshan. Yunyan raised his fly whisk and said, "Can you hear it yet?" Tongshan replied, "No, I can't." Yunyan said, "You can't even hear it when I expound the Dharma. How do you expect to hear it when non-sentient beings expound the Dharma?" So how does this relate to joy? And what came to mind to me in reading this story of non-sentient beings expounding the Dharma was one of the first stories of enlightenment we hear about in the Buddha's family by Mahakasyapa, who you might recall when the Buddha raised a flower, Mahakasyapa smiled. It's like these other Zen masters raising a fly whisk. Buddha raised a flower. And in that, this is my take. Mahakasyapa said to himself, "Dude, right on. You know, this is the Dharma. The flower is even a Dharma." You know, and he was probably joyful about it inside. And the Buddha could read it and say, "This guy's got it." Everybody else was waiting for him to say something significant, so he could hear something significant. And instead, it's always showing us. So that's, and I just in thinking about Mahakasyapa's sitting there joyful in this and seeing the Buddha expound the Dharma with just raising a flower, it just tickled him. It's a joyful tickle that he got. And it's important for us to, as we were talking yesterday, you know, not take things too seriously. But maybe a little seriously. Because there can be a lot of foolishness in not being in being there can be foolishness in not being serious, and I engage in that foolishness too often and it kind of hits me. But earlier in this he was also talking about how important Tongshan Zen master was telling him that Yunyan said it's important to get rid of these defilements that we have. So that's part of our work, as opposed to just talking about joy, but there's this work that we do. And last week, I think it was last week, I gave the talk and I talked about the Effacing Sutra, which talked about these multiple ways of there are those who covet. But here, we do not practice coveting. There are those who hate, but here we do not practice hate. And on. You know, there were 44 of these elements, and the last one was, there are those who do not like to be reprimanded, but here it's okay for us to be reprimanded. So there's a lot of subtle aspects to our practice, and even being criticized and pointed out to, it's important for us to welcome that as best we can. And I think most of us probably are learning to do that in our days. And it's not just from people that we get it. You know, of course, you know, when your mother or father says something to you and it's like, oh, geez, I got to hear that again. That's one thing. Or when somebody says, your barn door's down, you go, oops, pardon me. You know, it's important to be these things pointed out. But there are other times where just how we are handling an object or working the ground or maneuvering our vehicle, that it is the Dharma speaking to us too. And it lets us know when something's not right. And it's when we are frustrated with it, this thing or a person, we're not hearing the feedback. We're not hearing the criticism that is necessary in that moment to take best care. We're like, oh, geez, I bumped my head again. I got to learn to duck, you know. And so we learn to adjust, and thankfully we do, because we encounter other situations where it's important to duck, and you've had practice ducking, so it's like you walk into a closed passage, it's like, okay, I got this. I think so. I think I understand this. So to welcome these opportunities lightheartedly too, then it's really helpful to find our ground. And I want to read one last thing here. Tongshan said to Yunyin, I have some habits that have not yet that are not yet eradicated. Yunyin said, what have you been doing? Tongshan replied, I have not concerned myself with the Four Noble Truths. Yunyin said, are you joyful yet? Tongshan said, it would be untrue to say that I am not joyful. It is as though I have grasped a bright pearl in a pile of poop. So in the midst of all of this stuff we get to deal with, there was some sense of humor there, wasn't there? Between those guys. So, one last thing to talk about are the vows that we take. We say beings are numberless. I vow to save them. I'm wondering if maybe it's important to drop the I in there and instead say, beings are numberless, vowing to save them. I is an object, whereas it's an action that we want to talk about. And I want to bring up a couple other notions. Beings are numberless. Angie says, I vow to be with them. And another says, I vow to see them. Beings are numberless. I vow, vowing to see them all. Beings are numberless. Vowing to see them all. Beings are numberless. Being with them all. Delusions are inexhaustible. Vowing to put an end to them. Dharma gates are boundless. Vowing to enter them, investigate them with curiosity and ferocity at times. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. Vowing to become it. So, objectifying ourselves is often not helpful. I'm going to stop there. Thank you. So, did anything come up for anybody? Yes, Craig.
The sutras seem kind of formal, so I'm curious if there's any indication of how the Buddha spoke after enlightenment. Was there the objectification, or when he said "I," was there a way of saying it that it acknowledged what he was talking about? Was there a form of language that the Buddha used or his disciples that removes the subject-object relation? I the last part that you talked about, that's what it feels like you're saying is, it, in part, it's a message of non-duality, right? The part where you're saying, let's not emphasize the subjectivity of I. Mm-hmm.
So there's the sutras are, it's difficult for me to hear the Buddha sometimes in the sutras. You know, there's great notions that are shown in them. Recently, I've been reading Old Path, White Clouds that Thich Nhat Hanh wrote on the Buddha. Are some of you familiar with that? And it's just wonderful stories. And it's like the Buddha comes alive. But when for example, when he would take the bhikkhus into a village in the morning, they would do their begging. And the process was to take your bowl and be mindful of your breath and of every step. And so there was this reflective watching breath and your step with each, as you were going out begging for your food, and you'd go in front of a door and stop, watch your breath, and if no one made an offering, you'd turn and go to another door. And so in that there was, and whatever entered your bowl was then shared with the others. People brought it back and they shared it. And it was appreciated, whatever it was. And so there was the testing of one's notions of like, well, I want to go to that house over there because I know, you know, she's a good cook. I want to be that one that gets
my bowl to that door, you know? And so people would get to meet their covetingness in that. But basically, I'm sure you use the word I in Pali or Sanskrit or whatever there. I was bringing up this not using I in these vows that we say, like we're going to say at the end of this talk, and maybe as guiding teachers, we should consider, you know, a new redoing these vows so that they're that way. You like that idea? There's joy.
There's joy. I'm very happy with that idea. It's a subject I thought about a lot, and at various times made up my own vows and have looked at other traditions, vows, and other Soto Zen, you know, sanghas, vows. So there are a lot of wonderful forms out there, or several that I know. So maybe a lot is an exaggeration, but that do not use the word I at all. Mm-hmm. And early on, of course, what is this? Which is, like, Angie had a lot of students when she started out who had a lot of practice, but not with saying Zen vows. So, of course, that just, like, comes up. Wait a minute, what are all these beings we're... Who are all these beings we're saving, and who are we to be taking, you know, like we can do it? So she was pretty clear that, what she did was quote Koban. So I'm not, This is what I remember. This is what I remember. That would be my line instead of this I have heard, what I remember. And Koban said, all the beings you're saving are inside yourself. Which, it, you know, accords with, as I've gone on, it accords with other kinds of ways of looking at the mind and Zen ways. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a wonderful idea. Not sure. We have a cohort, so we'd have to see what others think.
Mm-hmm. Back to this last bit where Yunyan asks, well, have you found joy yet? And he says, well, yeah, when I find this pearl in this excrement, in this stuff, in this... And there's a couple of ways to look at it. There's the an optimist way of, like, you know, you're digging and you find a pearl. There's another way in that the whole stuff is actually a pearl of useful stuff, which feels better to me about how to look at it. It's that we want to embrace all of it, not just, ooh, that stuff, but there's a pearl in there. No, it's in this matter of I've got to deal with, I guess that's the diamond in the rough. One of my sons was in a bilingual class. And he had this most amazing teacher who treated every child in her class like a diamond in the rough. And it was so inspiring to hear that, you know, to I wanted to be able to vow to look at that people and situations that way.
But in a way, it's she found joy everywhere that way. To maybe not all the time.
Thank you for that that little anecdote you just told. That's a very it's very beautiful, I think. I too knew a teacher like that. She was my sister-in-law. She's gone now, but and she wanted to be a teacher. That's what she wanted to do, and she wanted to teach very young children because she just was delighted in them. And she taught art, and she saw every student like that, and what she brought out, what she could bring out of like 7-year-olds, the kind of, you know, it was just really beautiful to have that attitude. That was a teaching for me, you know, to like how if you teach, to look at just what you said, everyone like that as best you can. And Shanti Davis says that too. Everyone, I am a student of everyone, or I am a pupil of everyone. Let everyone teach us. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So as a place of refuge or a place of to manifest that this place is, I think one of the things that helps is this notion that Coben and I think Angie also imbibed in this place in its bylaws, and the notion that this organization has no hierarchy. And you can say yes and you can say no to that, you know, and both, there is hierarchy, of course. But to, for me, the feeling I get as an elder here and as, I have a voice here in my position here at Jokoji, it's one thing for me to say or appreciate no hierarchy. It's different from someone who's new here to say, oh yeah, I want, you know, no hierarchy. I'm sitting in your seat. Okay, take it. And maybe that'd be a good thing. But it for me, I guess what it's helped me do is maybe it helps with seeing everybody as a diamond in the rough too. Because we're all that way at whatever age and stage. I've been most everybody's age here except Jero's. I'm not quite Jero's age yet. But you never know what the future holds for any of you. Where you will be sitting, what you will be called to do, what you will be required to do. You know, it's like you might be one of the last ones standing in a situation and it's you that must carry on, you know? And that's what happens in our families too, when our elders die. And then pretty soon we're the last one, or maybe even the last one, that there are no descendants. And so it gets you know, this notion of caring, this notion of helping, these ways of that we manifest to make it so everyone can flourish as the best they can. It feels best to me in a situation where people try to have as little sense of hierarchy as possible, that everyone is willing to pitch in. And it's not so fun at places where it's like, no, you go do that one. Your time will come. And, you know, that's how it works sometimes, some places, but it's just wonderful when everybody can pitch in, and it the fabric is full then. The attention is generous and not partialized into certain ways. Ms. Craig.
Sometimes I find the lack of hierarchy here troubling, because it makes it hard for a novice or somebody who's not part of the community to find somebody who can give you a definitive answer. Not necessarily to a spiritual question, but more about the way things are here, or how decisions get made. It makes finding your place here more difficult, more challenging. Systems that have a hierarchy are ones where you're either going to fit into that system or you are not. Mm-hmm. You're a key or a Jenga piece, right? And if you can find your slot in that hierarchy and the rigidity, the rules, right? It's a very comfortable place to be mm-hmm. for some, to fit into a hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
In your talk, I was thinking about Jokoji as democracy. We tend to call what we have in the United States a democracy, but it's not. It's a republic. We elect leaders to fill out a hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding of democracy in Athens and was that all the citizens participate in the debate and the decision making. And it's extraordinarily messy, chaotic, slow, deliberate. You sometimes have to back up. But I also believe that the reason it works well is that a hive mind is always better than an individual mind. And I think that here in the democracy, chaotic democracy of Jokoji, having some people like yourself and Carolyn and Jiro, who are wise but not dominant, right? It's a different type of reverence that comes from the acknowledgement of wisdom versus the acknowledgement of a title or a position.
Mm-hmm.
I like the combination of wisdom and I'm I was going to say lack of intelligence, but I don't really mean that. But I mean like a lack of knowledge, right? So, for instance, somebody who like me who comes in as a novice and has not much understanding, it provokes your wisdom to have the novice questions come in, the novice perspectives come in. Mm-hmm. If the place is full of wisdom, then there's no growth, really. So I really appreciate, well, for one thing, one of the things I really didn't like about Christianity and Catholicism in particular was the hierarchy. There was nobody better than me. There was nobody above me. Even as a child, I would not acknowledge that. I would not acknowledge that authority, the authority of my parents, mm-hmm. right? So the lack of hierarchy can be a real turnoff for some who need to find their spot. Mm-hmm. But your willingness here to be open, even in your wisdom, to all of the practitioners and participants, I think is one of the things that will keep this place alive. Mm-hmm.
I want to correct your notion of that wisdom, at least for me, it's not something I carry with me in a bag or anything. It's more of a process of in the moment. It's like, oh, this is what's going to happen. And it's having been through it a bunch of times. So it's like, oh, okay, maybe this can work. Or no, this is time to back off. So it's a momentary thing. I don't think anybody, there's no storehouse of wisdom in this. Maybe there is in the body, like you duck. When I walk into the pantry, I duck. I don't know if you're tall enough, I cream myself numerous times. So there is wisdom in this body to duck in that moment. But in a way, one of the wonders of this place about the lack of how things get decided. I think it's helpful. I mean, it was helpful to me, and it made me laugh because, in a way, a lot of people get super anxious about, well, am I in or am I out, or you know, what's going to happen? What's next? Who are the people that decide? And I came to see for myself, as well as time and again with other people that were here, that was like day after day after day, no decision was made. And they were still here and could do all the things. And all there is today, you know, you can worry about, well, what's my status? Well, it's your whatever it is, where you're at today, you know, it's where you're at. But a lot of people get really distressed. Like, I need to know. What's my place? And I never could, and this is probably not kind on my part to really appreciate a person's anxiety over their lack of, or their sense of need to know. And I would just, in a lighthearted way, say, well, you know, things just aren't decided around here. So I don't get used to it. But it's hard to. But it's also a kind of a wonder that that's how it works, and it has worked. So you're seeing how Jokoji works by its lack of working, but it works.
Yeah. Well, I had a couple of things I would like to say. And one is about hierarchy, And what Craig said is that, yes, a lot of people, maybe the majority of people, at least this is my view, in the world, like hierarchy. And especially they like a leader. And especially they like someone that they can turn to. And here's my reasoning for that view, is because we take such a long time to grow up. We are, you know, at the edge, at the, you know, extreme of animals in how long we need to learn how to be as human beings in a human society. It takes, and we keep turning and hearing for answers. We keep asking and we keep getting the answer, or we get told, you know. So anyway, I just think that that's, so this need for hierarchy, also we're also herd animals in a way. Mm-hmm. And in most herds, there is a leader or packs, you know, whether it's horses or wolves. So matriarchs or patriarchs, I mean, it has different. Mm-hmm. So I think it's rather natural. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is, I don't know why at this particular time, in my lifetime anyway, there's been a kind of strong movement from the people I know anyway, away from that hierarchy, or a yearning to escape that kind of those kinds of what I would consider really natural hierarchies. Mm-hmm. Maybe even evolutionary. You know, and then there's, as you said, there's only today. So the other thing, I just, feel that there's, you're seeing Craig Jacoji at a certain moment in time. Mm-hmm. And there have been many moments in time in the history of Jacoji, and it hasn't always been working. So I'll just leave it at that. But I'm sure Doug can attest to that. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily because of hierarchy, but I think that's or the decisions, but I think that does play a part in it.
I wonder if it'd be better, more clarity to say there's no permanent or fixed hierarchy. Because, like, for the Sashin, you are in a hierarchical position as Tenzo, and I ask, do you need anything? You're not asking me, Doug, I can't do anything because I need your permission. You are the boss in the kitchen, and you, whatever you need, you're going to get. And you are in a hierarchical position in the efforts that you've taken to do with our water treatment system. You're getting into the guts of it and tearing it apart, putting it back together after cleaning it all up and seeing how it's working and talking to it and listening to it. And you know, so there's clear hierarchy. I turn to you in that. And likewise, you are dependable in so many key areas of showing up when you do that. You know, I don't want to assume anything, that, you know, it just is. So when people fit into the hierarchy here and make it work, because there's it's kind of flexible hierarchy. Maybe that's what it's about, that there is no fixed hierarchy, that we have a flexible hierarchy. And so it changes to, like, I'll be under the residence building soon, drilling holes for that sewer line to make it work. that no one else will want to do. And so hierarchy wise, I'm at the pedestal of that hierarchy. And we in times previous, we've had people here that would refuse to do easy stuff. You know, they, I'm a priest. I'm not doing that. And it's like, I don't know, it feels healthy to have a looser sense. So maybe it's no fixed hierarchy. And it's moving hierarchies. And that happens when there's respect, mutual respect. And maybe that's the point of the no hierarchy, is that there's fundamentally it's respect to everyone and what is done. And yeah, there's it's actually, I went to speak to Angie. Nico and I went to speak to Angie about this at one point, because she's on the board, and we were we wondered where that came from, this no hierarchy. Was that a Coben edict? And she said, well, partly, but it was also the place was owned, this was a high school. Jukuji was a alternative high school that was supported, that was founded by the Quakers. And I think the board of directors of that organization, when it was bought, maybe Angie had some Quakerness in her. I think there's an old Quaker lying down over here, brought up Quaker. And there are Quakers may operate with a semblance of no hierarchy, but they do have the heavies. I think that's what Angie called them, the heavies. That are the ones who take care of the business of stuff.
Yeah, there are weighty Quakers.
Oh, weighty Quakers.
Weighty Quakers.
Yeah.
I remember Angie talking about how what tough negotiators they were. No. The conditions, the deeds, the money. So they were the weighty ones, I guess.
Yes.
One thought around all this that we're talking about that I really appreciate from people here. And I think it's one of the elements why it makes it work. It's the taking responsibility, how people like are willing to take responsibility for a certain thing, take charge on this, take charge, right? They, at some point, they put a foot forward and they say, I can fix that, I'll fix it. And they take responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And like coming from a different culture, like in Spain, it's great for many things, but it's not a place where people like to take responsibility,
mm-hmm.
right? They get, it's better if someone else does it, kind of thing. And I find that here, like it's so much, so ingrained in the culture that you take the weight on, and you're gonna do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like admire that in general, of the mentality in at least in this part of the U.S. I don't know if the entire country, but at least in this part. And I think it's one of the really the big reasons why something like this can work, because it's people like. Everyone is willing to take a little part here and there, and then everyone kind of holds it up, right? And there's that thing of like of people willing to just, yeah, put them, just to take that on themselves.
Mm-hmm. Initiative, taking, it's a creative process too. Willing to take it on and deal with the obstacles that arise. But then maybe ask if there's a problem, you know, that mm-hmm. it's like you can't figure it out, right? Yeah. Thank you, Miguel. Craig.
Two terms that need to escape my lips. I had a lot of training in a high-performing organization with tens of thousands of people in it. And one of the things they talked about was, and you were trained in, was situational leadership, which sounds an awful lot like the flexible hierarchy mm-hmm. that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So that organization would be really good at recognizing the skills of different people and saying, in this situation, that your skills mean you're the leader. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then the other term that they trained us in was exactly what Miguel is talking about, and that is assumed responsibility. So you were basically not allowed to walk past a problem. You owned it until it was solved or until somebody else was formally assigned, the situational leadership was identified, right? And very high performing organization in which these two really critical precepts existed. And if you were not part of the, if you did not assume responsibility, you were let go. Now that's because they also had hierarchy and people who were identified as not, right? The priest who wouldn't do a particular thing would be let go in that organization.
Yeah.
Right. And I think there's some real merit to both of those things. And I think it's just really interesting that you guys have mm-hmm. developed and created and are living both of those principles, both of those precepts
of situational, so that,
situational leadership and assumed responsibility without somebody telling you what it was, or you know what I mean? So there's no hierarchy to tell you that, but you guys came up with it and it's working really well.
We're not the first though. I think I think in this valley has been inhabited for 15,000 years or more. And from recent readings I've done on the indigenous peoples in our country, they operated in this way of where everyone had a say. Someone was selected as a chief, but it wasn't the king. He wasn't the king. Mm-hmm. He didn't have all the material. He didn't have all these wives. He had expectations on him to take care of the least advantaged person in the tribe to make sure they got what goods. So maybe it's a naturally evolving way of being in certain organizations to do that. And I think it speaks well for our ancestry that others have experimented and thrived in it, only it comes to loggerheads when property is defined. So I don't know how we navigate through that in a larger culture. I mean, we're a nonprofit, so I don't own the land. You don't own the land, or we all own the land, or the organization. I'm not sure quite how it works, but it's and we're adjacent to public lands, which we all own, right? Because it's public. Anyway, it's good to talk about these things and define them clearly. I appreciate the assumed responsibility notion that could be expounded on, and situational leadership. So maybe this bylaw suggestion of no, this organization has no hierarchy, has allowed that these things to flourish here. And we're 40 years old. Jikoji is 40 years old. So.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.